First case on our calendar is 95-1334, In re Grand Jury, Mr. Porter.
If it may please the court, last week this court entered an order extending oral argument in this matter from 15 minutes to 20 minutes. After conferring with counsel for Mr. Metz, I'll be arguing for Mr. Elvis. I will be arguing first. It is my intent to use all 10 minutes of my time for Mr. Elkins. Any time that's remaining, I would use for rebuttal. After talking to counsel for Mr. Metz, it's his intent to use 8 minutes of his time, reserve 2 for rebuttal, and then a decision will be made of who will argue rebuttal when this issue is done with the argument.
Thank you.
You argue in this case that it's a substantial right being affected, and therefore that becomes the final appeal of the work. Aren't there two prongs to that issue?
There are.
For instance, it doesn't have to also determine the action and prevent a judgment or be a special proceeding?
Yes, and this is a special proceeding.
On what basis do you say that? I don't really think you argue that, but since I have found that, you mostly just talk about it being a substantial right.
We talked about it. It's in the first proposition of the law. In Polakoff versus Adam, this court, I believe, set forth a two-prong test to determine whether, in fact, it is a special proceeding. First, whether it is an action recognized at common law, and secondly, whether it's a type of proceeding on which an individual files an application or a petition with the trial court, or that it's a non-adversarial proceeding. The way the court set it up is, I think you need to focus in on the fact that this is not an appeal from an action as this court has consistently defined. In the case of Mission Society E.M. Church versus Eli, which this court cited in the Adams case, the court set forth the characteristics of which whether it would be considered in fact an action as opposed to considered an action as common law.
An action is part of it, but the other part, what you argue, I think, is that it's a special proceeding because it really wasn't known as common law. Are you saying that because this is a grand jury proceeding? And I would ask to that connection, isn't this just another routine discovery matter? Just happens to be maybe with a heightened aura about it because it's grand jury, but is it just discovering that we permit this to be a final appeal order? Why isn't every discovery, denial of every discovery or granting of discovery motion final appeal order?
Hey, I don't perceive this as to be a discovery matter. This doesn't come under Criminal Rule 16. I think the grand jury proceeding is separate and apart from the trial itself. Again, going back to the test this court put forward in versus Polakoff versus Adam, is you look at whether this is an action, if it's an appeal from an action, and the grand jury that we're appealing from this is a proceeding, which, again, if you apply the test this court put forth in 1897, since it's not an action but a proceeding, it fits under the test of that case.
Was the grand jury or some form thereof known in common law?
It was.
And if it was known in common law, doesn't that end the special proceeding issue?
No, because I think it needs to be an action from common law. And first, as we're asking the court to focus in on the first part of that element, is that it is an action.
But no,
it's not an action.
But no discovery motion is an action. It's only ancillary to an underlying action.
Right, but if you look at the other, there is no underlying action to look to in this case. And the typical discovery matter that comes before this court is a civil case. You can look at it and say, is this an action recognized in criminal law? It's obviously an action. We're saying in the particular factual scenario that's before this court, it's not an action as you defined it in your 1897 case. it's not something where the court put out three characteristics, and I know just that you're aware of it, is first is an action is defined as someone institutes an action against someone else. That's certainly not what occurs with grand jury proceeding. Secondly, in the year 1897 case, you defined it as there are pleadings, there's process, and someone gets to come in and defend. That's certainly not the situation in this case. And the third is that there results a finable, appealable judgment. And again, that doesn't occur in a grand jury. If an indictment was returned, that cannot be appealed. The case really has tremendous ramifications for outside this particular area. A scenario would be on a Medicaid fraud case. If a doctor's medical records got subpoenaed in, could an individual come in and defend because he or she did not want their actions given to the grand jury, given to the prosecutor. If for some reason the trial court finds that the records are not privileged, what recourse will that individual have other than give the medical records to the grand jury? The only remedy they can have is to an appeal at that
time. On that basis, in this case specifically, why couldn't the attorney just refuse, as he did at one point, to give the information, force a contempt finding, which is a final appeal order?
That is what occurred in this case. The real problem with what you have in this case is that which is not the standard that's traditionally been applied by this case. The Court of Appeals went into some detail about how the federal courts apply that standard. In this case, there were tremendous differences between Mr. Dunn, the attorney that was held in contempt, and Mr. Elkins at that point.
But he didn't appeal from his contempt finding.
Yes, Mr. Dunn did in the court, to the Court of Appeals. He chose not to pursue the matter to this court. And I think maybe that's the best evidence that Mr. Dunn could not adequately represent Mr. Elton's rights properly, is that he simply gave up after a while. I think it really becomes a situation in this case. One of the factual scenarios, or one of the developments of the facts that you could find in this case, is in fact that Mr. Dunn, the attorney, committed a fraud upon Mr. Elkins. For you all to determine.
And perhaps upon the trial court.
Also upon the.
Gave two different stories, didn't he? The trial court, the Judge Boyer, or is that not clear?
I think if you look at, given, I think initially because he's an officer of the court, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think he originally went to the trial court, or so he told the trial court on February 12th that the matter was privileged because he represented Mr. Elkins. I think he comes back later, I'm sorry, that was on February 9th. On February 12th, he comes back and he says, I used the wrong words. The matter is privileged. It's not because I represented or represent Mr. Elkins, but it's because he came to me for representation. And after he told me all the facts, I advised him I couldn't represent him because I had a conflict. I think you can do an interpretation, Chief Justice, that A, he lied to the court when he switched his positions, or B, he just didn't properly espouse the position.
Reading what I read from the briefs, I'm very concerned about his, and I, some of us are, about his conduct here. You don't need to, I mean, that's not for you to comment on, I guess, but there's some real concern about Mr. Dunn's conduct, it seems to me, and that it runs through the whole record. What we have, which makes it sort of difficult to.
It does, and
it's a legal issue.
I think if it works, your question works in the wrong response to Justice Douglas's question because there's a suggestion that Mr. Dunn, whose conduct could be questioned by this court, rightfully so, cannot be the person that represents Mr. Elkins' interest. We have something that's very fundamental in this case, the attorney-client privilege. It's not limited to criminal cases, it's all cases. And for someone to go forward that arguably could be interpreted as defrauded Mr. Elkins to say that he can represent Mr. Elkins adequately on appeal, I think is wrong.
Wasn't Mr. Elkins found, he was tried and found guilty?
You have two individuals here. Mr. Metz, the co-defendant, was tried and found guilty. Mr. Elkins, while this case continued on through the appellate process, has entered a guilty plea and the criminal charges was resolved against him. It does not moot the issue before this court.
That was my question. Why is it not moot?
It's not moot because just because you plead guilty doesn't mean that the prosecutor of the state of Ohio can get access to information in your file. For instance, if one of us get a divorce, if I get a divorce, and once the divorce gets worked out, the other side doesn't get access to the file. That's what the state of Ohio is really asking.
Well, but as to him, if there's access to the file here, how will it affect Mr. Elkins?
It affects Mr. Elkins first is that there's a violation of the attorney-client privilege. I think there's prejudice to all of us as attorneys because to say, well, this is a breach of privilege, but it's harmless, I think sends the wrong message to the legal community.
Maybe we punish the attorney for that.
Now, that doesn't sound like it affects Mr. Elkins. I mean, not directly, certainly. I mean, your statement is correct, but Justice Douglas said that sounds like punishment for the attorney, not a case that's kept alive based on it.
I think what it does, I can agree with you in part of your question, I think what it does move is I think it moots the state's interest in this matter. If they're no longer prosecuting Mr. Elkins, and Mr. Metz's case is now on appeal, but at least he's been convicted, I think it moots their interest. The black letter law in the state is once an individual is indicted, the grand jury cannot continue to investigate that individual. This is a case where not only both individuals have been indicted, but both individuals have been convicted. I think at that point, the state's interest is in fact mooted. I see I've used up all my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. Mr. Warner, you wish to go next.
But if we say the material is privileged, what good does that do, Mr. Elkins?
Your Honor,
and would he have pleaded guilty absent the alleged privileged material being available?
I can't answer for Mr. Elkins, but as for Mr. Metz, his case is ongoing. And since we believe the privilege is his, in this matter, the state's interest being moot, the only reason they can be before this court is to get access to evidence that is the work product of my client. And they have no legitimate reason to have grand jury proceedings ongoing at this point in time in an attempt to get evidence to further anything against my client if the Court of Appeals were to reverse his conviction on the variety of issues raised in that court. So I think in agreeing with the Chief Justice, the state doesn't have an interest anymore in this litigation. The privilege that my client has still exists because my client still has ongoing litigation going before a lower court. So I believe the interest still exists. I don't know what the state's interest is at this point.
Your client has the privilege because you argue that Mr. Dunn represented your client.
That is correct.
And that the information that Mr. Dunn got from Mr. Elkins would have helped your client, certainly, if it had been admitted.
It seems to be a double-edged sword from what the record says. I have not had access to the tape myself. It has been in a sealed posture, and I did not listen to it. But in the briefs and in the records, it does seem to indicate that there is evidence exculpating him from the aggravated murder, but maybe inculpating him as to the aggravated burglary or the aggravated robbery.
Why was the privilege not waived when it was played for the prosecutor? Would you address that argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. Basically, the privilege isn't waived because during plea negotiations, you should be allowed to have some leeway in what is discussed. If you suddenly make that admissible, you're contravening Rule 408 as well as State versus Lockett. And basically, if that privilege is now waived anytime you may discuss information, the whole concept that this court has been trying to instill in us is to mediate, to prevent further litigation and try and discuss matters ahead of time. That would send a chilling effect on that whole process. If we discuss a matter with opposing counsel in any context and have to worry about anything we say coming back to haunt us.
Could it be waived as to your client and not waived as to the other?
Your Honor, there is an argument that...
Whose privilege is it here?
The appellant, Metz, would assert it is Metz's privilege, not the attorney's privilege. However, there's no clear case law asserting whose privilege it really is. As the Chief Justice has indicated, Mr. Dunn's actions in this case are very, very inconsistent at the very least. And I think he's put everyone in a very awkward position as to who he was representing. But he clearly was representing Mr. Metz during this proceeding.
Dunn was representing your client.
That is correct. And he asserts that consistently throughout the proceeding.
And he plays the tape as an effort to achieve what?
At that point in time, Mr. Metz was only a juvenile. He was attempting to have Mr. Metz kept at the juvenile level and not have a Rule 30 hearing held.
So he was using it on behalf of your client?
At that point in time, yes. He was attempting a plea bargain to have the Mr. Metz stay in juvenile court and that maybe he would use the evidence in a proceeding later
in
cooperation.
Is it possible that there is waiver then as to your client but not waiver as to the adult who is not his client?
Your Honor, I don't think he waives within that context of negotiations. It would be similar to any type of evidence that you would bring up to kind of indicate we may have some evidence that is favorable to our client, you know, and may have someone else futurely indicted if you're interested, but if I have to present that and then waive it within that context, I'm not even going to talk to the prosecutor in that context.
Wouldn't that be part of the deal? I mean, Mr. Dunn is trying to make a deal on behalf of Mr. Metz, and certainly from the receiving end of that deal, the state said, yeah, okay, that's a deal. This will be a fine bargain because we now have that tape, which we can use against Elkins.
That is correct, but as in this case, the deal broke down and two different attorneys had different opinions as to what the deal may or may not have been, as was shown by the motions that were later filed in the case. If, in fact, the deal breaks down and one side gets what they want anyway, then you put one side of a case in jeopardy, because why should they be offering? Because if they don't get the deal and have it secured, that evidence is going to get used anyway.
Wasn't that the intention of Mr. Dunn initially? He was out to keep Metz in juvenile court, and so he was really using Elkins' tape to accomplish that.
That's what the record seems to indicate, that he was sacrificing Mr. Elkins for Mr. Metz.
And Mr. Elkins, and I didn't ask this of his attorney, had been represented by Mr. Dunn previously, hadn't he?
That seems to be unclear. There may have been previous representation, but it's unclear whether there was current representation, and counsel Mr. Dunn goes all over the place on that particular notion.
When Elkins came to Dunn, he probably came to him because Dunn had represented him before.
That would be a logical conclusion. Mr. Elkins testified at the grand jury. He thought there was representation there.
And he thought there was an attorney-client relationship.
And at least one judge in the court below also accepted that representation was initiated at that point.
Your client is Metz. Do you want the tape played?
Your Honor, if it's up to me, I want the tape.
Okay, so you are willing to say, under these circumstances, that an alleged confidential communication between an attorney and, at the worst, a pseudo-client is not privileged. Now, if you were representing Elkins, would you be saying that?
If I was representing Elkins, I'd be taking the position that there was proof that an attorney-client relationship existed and that it is Mr. Elkins' privilege, not the attorney's, to waive.
And that's why I'm wondering where we get the position that Metz has any say about it at all. Metz doesn't have anything to waive. This is Elkins' privilege. Even the attorney can't waive the privilege.
There is more than one privilege at stake here, Your Honor. Unfortunately, the attorney here was wearing dual hats and indicating he was representing Metz and that he gathered the information on Metz's behalf.
But that's not, is that privilege or are we really just talking conflict of interest?
There's still an underlying privilege beyond the conflict of interest that Mr. Dunn's created.
Communication, right, counsel? We talk about privileged communication. So what communication?
We have two privileges here. We not only have the attorney-client privilege, but we have the work product privilege, and it is clearly Mr. Metz's work product privilege.
Nothing was gained from the telephone conversation that was taped at the jail, was there? There were no admissions during that conversation between Metz and Elkins.
I am not aware of what was specifically said in that particular part of the tape.
My question is that tape is not an issue.
That tape is not an issue. The only tape that my understanding is at issue is one that Mr. Elkins makes
to Mr. Dunn.
Correct.
Your argument on that is not attorney-client privilege in terms of communication. That was not a communication between that attorney. Yours is the work product. Correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
You're claiming the work product was not waived because it was disclosed only to plead to our settlement setting.
That is correct, Your Honor. And we believe that's very vital to this case.
And so you say work product, that privilege is the client's privilege or the attorney's privilege?
Your Honor, I have seen this court and other courts not be specific as to having made that decision. We would assert it's the client's. However, I don't think you need to reach that decision in deciding this case. I think that within the context of plea negotiations or civil settlements or anything, if you start going into that issue and allowing disclosure outside the context of the negotiation, you're opening up an area that you do not want to open up. Thank you.
Where's the case go if we say no final appeal board?
I would presume that I would go down to the trial court and file an extraordinary writ saying that there's no grand jury proceedings that are necessary. I want my take back.
Because the case is over because of conviction?
Because there's a conviction of Mr. Elkins and there's no need for them to have the tape but to use against my client, which I think is their intention here.
You say you want the tape back. Where is the tape now?
I believe it is now with the court.
With the court?
You said the ongoing litigation. Hasn't your client been convicted?
There is an ongoing appeal, Your Honor.
Your client's been convicted?
That is correct.
So the only thing the tape would do is be evidence alienandi or some such thing outside the record to argue on appeal. How can you do that if it wasn't raised at the trial court?
Your Honor, the issue was raised at the trial and Judge Lane would not allow the tape into evidence and quashed the subpoena, and that's when they turned around and used the grand jury proceedings to try and get what they couldn't get otherwise.
Now, isn't that an assignment of error in a direct appeal?
If it had been ruled the other way, yes. The complication in this case is it came up through the grand jury. And if you say I don't have a remedy in the grand jury, I am without a remedy in this case, and that's why it's a final appealable order as to Metz.
How? Explain that. How are you without a remedy? Your client's convicted without the tape. So, and now you're on appeal.
All right, back into the grand jury context of this matter, whether it's a final appealable order, the one factual difference between Metz and Elkins is that our position for a remedy is we can't wait normally until Mr. Metz's or whoever that person is, his entire proceedings, to then appeal something that went wrong with the grand jury. We're going to have some real problems. The unique factual scenario here, I think you will find, is an extremely unique one and doesn't necessarily encompass broad balancing tests that this court has used before. I think you'll find it's very unique unto itself.
If you get the tape by our order, can the tape be used in a post-conviction proceeding for Mr. Metz?
By Mr. Metz, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Warner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rings.
Thank you. I believe, Your Honor, the key to this particular case, especially with respect to Mr. Elkins, is the existence or the non-existence of an attorney-client relationship. The trial court and the court of appeals found that, in fact, no attorney-client relationship existed between Mr. Elkins and Mr. Dunn. The trial court made some very specific findings of fact in which it said there was no evidence to support the conclusion that there was, in fact, an attorney-client relationship. Without the existence of an attorney-client relationship, every argument that Mr. Elkins has made...
What's key? What happened there?
makes no attorney-client relationship. So that seems to be key to your whole investigation.
Yes, sir. I believe what happened was that Mr. Elkins was aware that his very good friend, Mr. Metz, had been arrested and charged with an aggravated murder, aggravated burglary, and aggravated robbery. He knew that Mr. Dunn represented Mr. Metz. And when he went to Mr. Dunn, he did so not for the purpose of obtaining legal advice for himself, but for the stated purpose of helping his friend, Sam. He went there to get a tape recorded statement, or get some evidence, a statement turned out to be a statement. He went there to give this evidence to Mr. Dunn so that Mr. Dunn could then use the tape on behalf of his client, Mr. Metz. That was why he went there, to give him evidence that Mr. Dunn could then use in an attempt to have Mr. Metz treated as a juvenile in order to have the state dismiss its finder.
There had been no prior history of attorney-client relationship between these two people.
Sir, I don't know that for sure. There is some mention that many years before, when Mr. Elkins was also a juvenile, he may have had delinquency proceedings in which Mr. Metz represented him. That could
well, but if Elkins regards this guy as his lawyer, the only lawyer is their head, and he goes in and I assume he has some understanding, just as priest kind of that what he goes in and tells the guy that he's always regarded to be his lawyer is confidential.
When the matter was presented, when Mr. Elkins appeared before the grand jury, he stated that his previous attorney had been Buell and Sipe, other attorneys in Marietta. They were the ones who had represented him most recently. So he had had a history of representation, and most recently it was by attorneys other than Mr. Dunn. And again, Mr. Elkins knew that Mr. Dunn represented Sam Metz, and that's why he went to him, not for any advice for himself, but so he could help his friend.
Did Elkins specifically deny that there was any thought in his mind that there was an attorney-client privilege between he and Dunn?
No, sir. In fact, he made a number of contradictory statements. He first said in front of the grand jury that he was not represented by an attorney. Then he said that my attorney in the past has been attorneys Buell and Sipe. And then he said, well, Mr. Dunn is my attorney. And these things were all considered.
What would you say there must be some magic words that must be used by the client to indicate that an attorney who he has used in the past, an attorney who he is coming to discuss the case that he had information for, and an attorney that he picked out to discuss this with, is there something to say that he has to say, well, now you know that I want you to represent me and here's $5? Or does the context of his coming there, the type of information that he has to deliver to the attorney, all those factors, doesn't that enter into a legal conclusion of whether there is a relationship between the two parties?
Absolutely, sir.
And in this case, isn't it more probable than not that there was a relationship involved?
I don't believe so, nor did the trial court, nor did the court of appeals.
So they can be wrong.
Yes, sir. But I would suggest that the trial court was in the best position to judge the evidence, to view the people who were making these claims, and to judge the credibility of those witnesses. And the judge's trial court's decision, determination of facts, was very clear.
So this was just sort of a social call.
No, sir. No, sir.
Social call on the lawyer. He just went in because he wanted to pass the time of day with him.
In the neighborhood. He went in specifically, sir, to offer evidence to Mr. Dunn that Mr. Dunn could use in his representation of Mr. Metz.
To his own detriment.
Yes, sir. To his own detriment.
Now, if we conclude that the trial court feels it was wrong in determining that there's no attorney-client relationship existed, we conclude that's wrong. Are you done? Is it over for you at that point?
No, sir. I'm not. Nor am I finished, sir.
He hopes he's not done.
No, sir. At that point, then I think we have to go on and deal with the issue of, for example, applying the favorable order. And as the court has already discussed before with Mr. Porter, I don't believe there's a final appealable order at that point.
But as to the issue of whether or not you could use the tape in the grand jury, if there's attorney-client privilege, do you agree you can't use the tape as to Elkins?
As to Elkins?
Yes, sir.
You yes. agree?
Okay, then what as to Metz?
Well, again, this was a grand jury subpoena issued for the investigation of criminal activity against Mr. Elkins, not against Mr. Metz. So at that point, if it's a privileged communication, again, that would have to be an overruling of the trial court's finding that none existed.
So for you to lose, we have to do two things. We have to determine it's a final appealable order, and that there was an attorney-client relationship, at least there was an appearance of it. Whether money changed hands, that Mr. Elkins went in under the belief that he had the protection of attorney-client.
So I believe he has to do one more thing. I think one more finding. And that is you have to find that Mr. Elkins intended that this communication be kept confidential. I think the facts very clearly indicate that his intent in making that statement was for it to be played for somebody else. He knew and intended that statement that he made. He intended for that statement to be shown to the state of Ohio. That was the whole purpose of him making it, was for somebody else to hear it. And if that's the case, then he has in fact waived any right to confidentiality or the privilege to protect that statement. So even if you find that the attorney-client, where he went to Mr. Dunn for legal advice and trying to establish an attorney-client relationship, it does not necessarily follow that the tape and the conversation contained thereon is privileged.
So even if there is privilege, that he specifically waived it or authorized
yes,
the use of the tape?
Yes, sir. The facts surrounding its creation indicate that its purpose was to be disclosed.
So what did he say in the grand jury about authorizing it?
I don't believe he addressed that specifically. I don't think that was ever stated.
What did the attorney say?
Pardon me?
What did the attorney say?
Nothing. He refused to answer the questions.
Does Metz ever work product to a privilege?
No, sir. I don't believe that he does. Oh, sorry. Metz.
Metz.
Yes, I do believe this is work product. But I believe that has been waived when the tape was played. The counsel for Mr. Metz has argued that criminal evidence rule 410 would prevent this from coming out.
Now, does he have to show some detriment from that information, or can beneficial work product information be used?
I'm not sure that whether it's beneficial or detrimental, it is really the deciding factor. This tape itself,
all work product information then is privileged.
It can't have that privilege when it's created, sir. But I believe that what happened here is he came to us and showed us. This is not a statement as contemplated by evidence rule 410. It's evidence.
No, but get to the subject of information obtained in pre-bargaining sessions.
Yes.
What is your contention that information can or cannot be used at a later point?
Statements made during the course of plea bargaining sessions cannot be made, but evidence that is revealed, the existence of that evidence that is revealed during those sessions, is not automatically protected under evidence rule 410.
What makes it that it's not automatic? What other factors does it play here?
Evidence is never protected. The statements under the evidence rule are protected. If the attorney, in the course of plea negotiations, were to admit to an attorney from the state, hey, my client's guilty, but there are extenuating circumstances, and so you should offer him a reduced charge, the state could not then come back in trial and stand up in front of a jury and say, the defense lawyer himself admitted his client was guilty. That's the kind of thing that is not permitted. Statements made during the course of...
But if he gives you a tape during those discussions that proves or gives some credibility to his allegations, then you can't use the conversation, but you can use the tape.
Yes, sir. Yes, there's a case which is very similar, which is cited in the state's brief, I think it's called Malzac, in which the defense revealed ballistics tests that were incriminating to the defendant. And then they tried to argue that because these ballistics reports had been revealed during the course of plea negotiations, that they could not then be used or subpoenaed by the state in the trial. The court said, no, that's not a statement, that's evidence. And I believe this tape falls under that same analysis. It's not a statement made during the course of negotiations. It's evidence of the crime.
Let me ask you this whole issue, one of the nature of discovery and therefore properly attacked, if it can be attacked at direct appeal.
I believe so, sir. Yes, sir. There are things that could be done at the trial level. For example, a motion to suppress could be filed at trial. A motion to eliminate could be filed at trial.
Well, we're past the trial.
Yes, sir. But, I mean, those are remedies that were available, and as you say, they could be raised on direct appeal at the trial.
Are you involved in the direct appeal events?
Yes, sir.
Has the notice of appeal and brief been filed?
Yes.
Do we know whether or not they raise as an assignment of error the exclusion of the tape?
No, I don't believe it's been directly raised, although Mr. Warner could answer that question better, representing Mr. Metz on appeal.
Well, if you're handling the appeal, you should know what's on the other side's brief.
Yes, sir, but I don't recall that specifically raised. I think it may have come up in the context of other arguments, for example, ineffective assistance.
Assuming that Mr. Dunn represented both Mr. Metz and Mr. Elkins, could he do that effectively?
I'm sorry, sir?
Could Mr. Dunn represent both Mr. Elkins and Mr. Metz effectively in these cases?
No, sir. Again, I would ask the court to affirm the decision of both the trial court and the court of appeals and find that, in fact, no attorney-client relationship existed. If that finding is made, then I believe Mr. Elkins' arguments, the rug is pulled out from under them. Similarly, with respect to Mr. Metz's work product argument, clearly the tape would be work product, but that privilege is waived when he played the tape for the state of Ohio.
As a prosecutor, do you ever have confidential witnesses, informants, come into your office? And have you ever, as a prosecutor, said, well, we know what you did 3 years ago. Would you like to tell us about what's happening now? And does that not remain confidential?
Yes, sir. I can't think of a specific example, but
so,
I can.
That's why I'm asking. So if, having been through it, if that's the case, why should it be any higher, quote, privilege on the prosecution side than it should be on a defendant's side when it's a person's liberty at stake?
Are you speaking, sir, of an attorney-client privilege or a work product privilege?
Either. I don't care. Work product is a derivative of an offhanded comment in the Hawkins case years and years ago. If you look for our definition, you can't find one until you get to Moskowitz on what even work product is. So we just all sort of use it as an amorphous term. We all sort of understand. But privilege is really what we're talking about.
Yes. If it is in fact a work product, as applied to Mr. Metz, then yes, it would be entitled to protection, but for the waiver. But for the waiver. In addition, there are arguments that the work product privilege is not absolute. And there are certain conditions under which that privilege can be trumped or overborne. I think the circumstances, you know, that are set out in the brief exist here. There was a very special need for this.
Let me ask you the same question I asked the other side. Where does this case go if we find no final appeal board?
Again, I think it goes back
to the Court of Appeals on the direct appeal on Metz.
Specifically, I think it goes back to the trial court, and the state of Ohio would get the tape that Judge Boyer has been holding under seal all this time.
But you only want it vis-a-vis Elkins, vis-a-vis Metz.
No, sir. I think part of this is that we have an obligation to vindicate the authority of the grand jury.
Oh, wait. Let's not talk about who we're going to vindicate. Mm-hmm. We're talking about two live people here.
Yes, sir.
Who have both been convicted.
Yes, sir.
Now, why do you need anything else? Do you need to add a 2x4 to the vise?
No, sir. As the court is aware, the conviction of Mr. Metz is under appeal.
Okay, well, let me ask this then. Has not the trial court lost jurisdiction? Notice of appeal divests the trial court of taking any action that deters the appellate court from either affirming, reversing, or modifying. Now, you want to go back to the trial court and demand the tape and use it at least in one case and maybe two. Those cases are over.
We may not have to use it at all. We may not have to use it at all.
Now you just want to see what's on it, really.
No, sir, I know what's on it. I heard it.
Okay.
I think where I would like to see this tape used is this, Your Honor. If the conviction of Mr. Metz is overturned and Mr. Metz is retried, I can see Mr. Elkins coming out of prison, taking the stand in the prosecution of Mr. Metz, and telling the jury, I did it all. Mr. Metz was home in bed at the time the crime occurred. And I would love to be able to play that tape and say, that's not what you said before. I think it would be impeaching if Mr. Metz, and again, I'm sorry, Mr. Elkins, again, this is something I can see him doing, because when he went to Mr. Dunn, that's in essence what he did. He wanted to take responsibility for his friend. Mr. Elkins is now serving a lengthy sentence in the state of West Virginia. I think he has not only power charges, but also a homicide or murder charge out of that state. And he could take the stand very easily and tell a jury, I did everything. Mr. Metz was nowhere around.
Do you have any reason to anticipate that Metz's conviction is going to be overturned on appeal?
Well, we'll wait and see.
Well, did you have any noticeable error at trial?
As the court has noted, the statement of facts here is so bizarre, so unusual, it would not be difficult for the Court of Appeals to find something that they might determine would require a reversal.
And shouldn't we then, in the first instance, at least have something before us from the Court of Appeals vis-a-vis the release of the tape before we ever make that ultimate decision?
Yes, sir. Again, if there are no further questions, I would wrap up at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ramos. Mr. Porter, you may take a minute for rebuttal. You've used your time.
Just very briefly, in response to Justice Resnick's question, Mr. Dunn had previously represented Mr. Elkins, but I want to use my 1 minute for it because I answer a lot of questions on final appeal order. Is I direct your attention to pages 15 through 19 of the February 12th hearing before Judge Boyer. She had an ex parte conference with Attorney Dunn. Attorney Dunn, at pages 15 to 19, repeatedly told the court that it appeared to me that Michael Elkins was coming to me because he either thought I was representing him or I could represent him. And at that point, I advised him I could not represent him because I had a conflict. Judge Boyer's question at that point is, did you advise him of that before or after he told you this statement? He said, I have clearly advised him only after I had received the statement that is issued in this case. I believe the scenario before this court is pursuant to Attorney Dunn's statement to Judge Boyer that Michael Elkins went there thinking that either Attorney Dunn was going to represent him or was representing him. He told him the statement, and it wasn't until that point that Attorney Dunn told him he couldn't represent him. That is indeed privileged information.
What about Metz's, the argument that this is evidence, this is unlike a statement by the lawyer in a settlement conference that a client did it, but, he's been in church every Sunday, and so you got to cut him some slack. This is evidence. This is not
I think the real problem at that point is if we use Attorney Dunn's statement, is he's told Elkins he can't represent. There's a conflict.
there's no way he can be down there talking to the prosecutor trying to do something for Mr. Elkins because he's already
I'm saying as to Metz. It's not your client.
Okay, I'm a real concern because there's always give and take. You try and work something out. In this particular case, part of the plea bargaining process for Mr. Elkins to enter his plea, which he already has, is we had to make a statement to the prosecutor and they had to find that acceptable. And it was surely my intent, surely the intent of counsel for Mr. Elkins, that that statement would not be used if that statement wasn't found acceptable. And the same rules should apply with respect to the disposition of Mr. Metz's case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.